This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is our great pleasure to have Anne Harrington, Dr. Anne Harrington, with us. Bill Russell, you were talking as we were going away about brings us back to the stories. The notion that our stories are so profoundly informing of who and what we are continues to be one that I think we just, as you say, it's like the fish in water. And many of the things that contribute both to the current condition and to the whole subject of mind-body are directly impacted by stories, and we do have some control over what stories we accept, mm-hmm. what stories we tell, what stories we are willing to move forward. With the mind-body in particular, it seems that that is a story that is relatively new, that there are folks, I mean, it's really easy to say, oh, well, that's New Age. No, this is a long history. New Age, as it were, has a piece of it. And some of it is a really long story that goes back at least 2,500 years when you're looking at the Tibetan Buddhist elements that are more than just the Tibetan. The stories themselves are worth a lot of attention from us, are they not?
I think they are, because that's why I've written a whole book about them and why I'm here chatting with you about it today. But let me just say something, add a piece that is maybe important to put on the table also, which is about where modern medicine fits into this, which is, of course, the dominant mode of healing that people turn to still in our culture.
And Western medicine.
Western medicine. Mm-hmm. And its story. Because in anthropologists, medical anthropologists actually talk about the modern medical narrative quite explicitly, and it's quite a simple but quite a powerful story, which is basically that when you get sick, something's broken down in your body, and you go to somebody who you call a doctor, and that person fixes you. We were talking before the break about when patients get insulted, when the doctor says to them, it's all in your mind, or what... A lot of patients do go to doctors in order to be fixed, and it's a very appealing and seductive kind of narrative. Something's wrong. Please give me a pill. Please open me up and cut that bit out of me that's making me sick so I can go back to being just the way I was. I don't have to work at it. It's your responsibility to do the hard work. And I will be just the same as I liked how I was before, and I want to go back to being how I was. There's an anthropologist... named Robert Frank, who talks about this as the restitution narrative. I was fine, I got sick, I went to the doctor, I'm better again. What I think happens is that there's a lot of instances when this story fails people. And so you need to ask, when are people drawn to alternative stories? Mind-body medicine isn't necessarily the default mode of healing that people turn to. They turn to it when either the modern medical narrative fails to properly explain their experience or when it fails to help them. So it is important to understand that this is to an important extent an alternative, but a very potent one, and it's one that's taken hold in parts of medical culture where modern medicine often hasn't done as well. So it's been particularly powerful in those parts of medicine that deal with chronic disorders, where people are living with their diseases rather than getting better from them quickly. You want to look like you want to say something.
Well, I'm wondering, as you say this, I'm wondering where death figures into this, because at least in the Western fix-it...
Denial, I think.
Well, precisely.
That's a great question.
It seems that you've got to factor in death if you're going to be in any of these narratives, and of course...
It's a great question, and I once gave a... talk at a big symposium that Herbert Benson, who has been involved in this field for many years, offered, gave on, and it was, set up this symposium, it was on death and dying. And I was asked to do something on mind-body medicine and death and dying. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't know anything about death and dying. And I went and looked up in the index of some of the most recent books coming out to see what do they have to say about death and dying. And there was no reference to death and dying. So to an important extent, I think death is as much a failure in the eyes of people who are committed to mind-body medicine as it is in the eyes of people who are committed to the modern medical narrative. Both have a lot of trouble. There are noble exceptions, but it's, you know, in the broader tradition, hospice traditions, certain aspects of Tibetan medicine, but not necessarily the aspects that are most attractive to Westerners. Even when we turn to mind-body medicine, we want to be fixed. And it's the rare person who can move beyond that and see, well, I need a narrative now that will help me die well. It's a great question, and it's not a very well digested question.
There is this sense that until we can accept death as part of life, we have yet to understand life.
Well, I think I don't disagree with that. I don't even know what to say beyond that. That's right. Well, go on.
One of the people you're here with, Pema Dorje, the last time he was here in Atlanta with a group of Western doctors.
He being a Tibetan doctor who is the principal physician for His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
They, in front of God and man and the rest of us, did basically a diagnosis of a man who's terminally ill with cancer. And at some point, the Western doctors did their variant of it, and then he did his variant. And somewhere in the course of that, I think he stopped the whole place. He said, "So what's your idea of the meaning of life?" And it just recalibrated the whole process, because what it did, again, it stepped back and radically contextualized all these detailed discussions that were going on, and it changed everybody's perspective.
What did he say?
He basically broke down in tears and talked.
This is the dying man, not the Tibetan. Yes, doctor. Yeah,
right. And sort of said something. This guy was incredibly brave to do what he did.
Yes, he would have been.
It was a stunning thing to watch. But basically, he talked about his family, his wife and family, and then he sort of into the things that he wasn't going to be able to do.
And having broken down in tears, he then found, you could watch joy emerging out of this. Mm-hmm. Because at that moment, he could see that for as long as he was going to live, he could do it, as the Tibetans might say, mindfully. That he would be present with his family and with those things that mattered, and then he would die. But it eased that passage in a remarkable way just in the course of conversation. And one of the stories you talk about is how powerful our talk is.
Right.
That the narrative isn't just a thing that you look at a distance, that it's so central in who and what we are.
Well, there is a whole narrative within mind-body medicine that says that by talking sets you free. Talking is itself healing. And certainly our common sense experience of that is powerful. And our religious traditions tell us that this is powerful. Confessionals is a central part of certainly the Christian tradition, and to a certain extent beyond that. But the narrative, the body that speaks, says that it's through taking the things that are inside of you and bringing them out into a social space and having that these are powerful.
Does that complete the thought you were bringing forth about what Dr. Pema Dorje was saying?
Well, the other interesting thing was that at least one of the doctors who deals, is an oncologist and deals with this all day, every day, and I think mm-hmm. this was this man's oncologist.
Very famous in the world.
Said, I've been doing this wrong all the time, and what I've failed to do is include the person. It's this core issue.
Well, let me say something about that, because that touches something I feel quite strongly about also. Another sort of strand that I've been pursuing, as I've been interested in broadly in this history, is a current interest in medicine in the extent to which religion can heal you, that religion is good medicine. And there's a whole various kinds of pieces of evidence that suggest that if you go to church regularly, you will live longer than someone who doesn't go to church regularly, or that if you meditate, you'll live longer. That various kinds of religious practices can have therapeutic implications.
Religious and spiritual, as you say.
Right, spiritual, but a lot of it is been. A lot of the way in which it represents itself, they do use the word religion quite a bit. And that's with design, because one of the hopes that people who have been involved in this effort to investigate the health benefits of religion or spirituality, one of their hopes is that this will lead to a different kind of medicine, one in which religion and the religious leaders or pastors and so on and medical doctors work hand in hand, and these things are integrated. And one of the problems that I've had with this vision is just your point, I actually think. The implication is that somehow this is going to make medicine a more spiritual kind of endeavor, but I don't think that's going to be the effect at all, because what if you turn religion into another therapeutic modality, and you integrate it with medicine. Medicine now has more therapeutic modalities, but it's still more of the same. what this vision of integrating religion with medicine fails to appreciate is just what your cancer patient pointed out, what's important to people who are very sick isn't always or inevitably, certainly at a certain point, what's the next thing I can do to fix myself. It's like, what does it all mean for me? Religion is as much about making meaning as it is about making better. And I don't think that, therefore, and that's just that point that seems to get missed in these endeavors. There's a beautiful anecdote that I think you read this in one of the things that I sent to you in advance. Anatole Broyard was a journalist who was dying and wrote about his experiences in the New York Times and talked about his hunger to have his physician stop, just stop for a minute, stop trying to fix him, stop putting him in machines, and just listen to what was in his heart and soul. Just commune with him and hear what was important, and complain gently about the fact that his physician was so keen on doing what he thought was his job and doing his heroic best that he never was able to do that. And I do think that there's a place for these kinds of things that isn't medical. And in our interest to see how to integrate the best of both, we sometimes should let them just be what they really are.
Well, it was one of the fascinating things about that question because, you know, when was the last time somebody asked you the meaning of life? Probably when you were a sophomore in college.
Mm.
Or at least the last time you took the question seriously.
And there was always at 2 in the morning after you kind of, you know.
Bad wine. You hurt more the next day. Part of what I think it said is that this science tends to want to generalize. I mean, that's sort of what science does. And a lot of this has to do with the individual. It's the story you tell. It's what this guy was saying, and it's what Pema Dorje was asking. What's your meaning of life?
Right.
Not what is he didn't not wasn't the.
Right.
What does life mean to you? Yeah. And that gets it off into a very particularized, very personalized. It's a consequence of these stories and more generally of the narratives that we inhabit, but it also is particularized by the individual.
And coming back, I mean that coming back to the mind body stories, if I may, one of the things that they do allow is for people to personalize them, and for people, if one isn't working for them, you can pick another. These are very much mix or match sorts of narratives, sorts of stories, and you may find that you start off, if you say you're a cancer patient, you'll start off with you know I'm committed to the modern medical narrative. I'm going to see. If I can get fixed, and maybe it's not working, well, maybe I'll see, you know, they say there's this research that says that if I spend time with other people talking and, you know, maybe it'll help me live longer. So I'm going to sign up for a support group, and I'm also going to do some visualizations because there's another narrative here that says if I, you know, really focus on the positive, it will, you know, it's going to help me. You know, maybe I do this for a while, and then maybe after a while, none of these, my personal experience shows that none of these seem to be working for me. And then I'm maybe out of a medical realm altogether. Mind-body medicine has its limits also, just as mainstream medicine does. And maybe it's at that point that I begin to say, well, maybe I'm no longer on a journey to being healed, but now I'm on a journey to deciding what it's all meant and how I'm going to now end my life well. And maybe it's at that point that you reach outside of medical traditions into, you know, more overtly spiritual traditions that are set up to help you do just that.
This is Ann Harrington. She has thought a great deal about the mind-body connection, both within and without science. As a historian of science, mostly within in this particular case. Be with us when we return in a moment.